In at least one instance, the CIA's reaction appears to have led to significant changes in the story that was eventually published in the Times. Clearing stories in advance and carrying official cooperation and approval automatically compromises the integrity of the journalist's handiwork. One of the CIA's long-standing favorite tactics is to generate favorable, including outright bogus, news stories in foreign media outlets, with the expectation that American outlets will eventually pick them up. There is no question that the U.S. government still recruits foreign journalists for propaganda missions in their home countries. For example, the United States and Britain have mounted an extensive joint propaganda effort regarding the Syrian war, using an array of West Asian reporters and columnists. The potential blowback phenomenon is a worrisome example of how the intelligence agencies can manipulate the debate on a foreign policy issue in the United States. It is unsettling how often most mainstream media outlets advance the agenda of the narrative put forth by the CIA and other portions of the national security state. More recently, the news media disseminated allegations that Saddam Hussein had a vast arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. Nearly all that information came from Iraqi exiles that the CIA supplied to friendly journalists, including New York Times reporter Judith Miller. Perhaps most striking major media outlets, especially the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, and MSNBC, have avidly joined the National Security State's campaign to demonize Russia. Those media heavyweights enthusiastically promoted the false narrative about the collusion between Donald Trump's campaign and the Russian government to influence the 2016 presidential election. Even worse, they parroted the CIA's unsupported far-fetched allegation that Moscow had paid the Taliban bounties to kill American soldiers. It is possible that the willingness of journalists to be megaphones for the CIA on such issues merely reflects inherent gullibility. However, given the long track record of collusion, it is likely that the intelligence community is systematically working with willing allies. The American people who count on the news profession to provide them with accurate, independent information about foreign affairs are the ultimate victims.
We get people.
U.S. Media Monopoly.
The role that the media and the press play in the United States is crucial for both people high up in power and for those on the streets. It's no surprise that spreading disinformation has real-world consequences. In some cases, dangerous ones. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javan Mardi, and in this episode, we will ask, how much of the truth does the mass media reflect as the human quest for truth continues? We will try to find out what potential dangers could be arising from the monopoly on mainstream media in the United States. And then, what about the viewers facing a barrage of fake news and partisan media channels? Is there any trust left? Thank you for staying with us.
It amazes me when I read the Wall Street Journal, which is always so negative, It amazes me when I read the New York Times is not even, I barely read it. You know, we don't distribute it in the White House anymore, and the same thing with the Washington Post. They are siding with China. They are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're siding with many others. China's the least of it. It is fake news. It's more than fake news. It's corrupt news.
Media outlets work based on profit, and they have never been more consolidated than today. They tend to give their consumers what they want to hear and act in the interests of the umbrella corporations controlling them. On the other hand, U.S.-owned social media such as Twitter and Facebook are amplifying disinformation and cracking down on freedom of speech.
What they choose to fact-check and what they choose to ignore or even promote is nothing more than a political activism group or political activism, and it's inappropriate.
But I think one of the most terrifying parts of it involves a suggestion that the government should be setting ground rules for what speech is or is not allowed on a platform.
Today, concentration of media ownership by only a few companies or individuals has a big say in the United States' political spectrum. Former President Donald Trump was banned from Twitter after he refused to accept the election result. Yet for years, Trump had been using the platform to issue threats to other nations and politicians. We're now joined by Mr. Tim Kirby. Mr. Kirby, please tell us about the disinformation being projected today and how it's changed through time, and what makes it unique and specifically dangerous.
This is nothing new, and disinformation has existed throughout all time, and even during the more golden age of the media that people sort of prop up, like the 50s and 60s and 70s, this height of journalistic integrity, even then it really existed as well. So I don't think that disinformation existing is particularly different now. The difference is that with the rise of the internet and the accessibility of the internet, the speed and the ability to be disinformed from various different sources has sort of changed the nature of the game. There's more competition, and the speed is much faster.
Trump's lack of access to Twitter has indeed shifted the dynamics of the so-called MAGA movement under President Biden. The particular platform that has blocked certain figures will lose their supporters not just on the platform, but also in the stocks. Twitter shares closed down more than 6% lower on the first trading day after the Trump ban.
We've seen abuse, we've seen harassment, we've seen people leave our platform because of it, we've seen voices being silenced because of what's happening on the service, and that is number one. Like, we can't build a platform of speech, a platform of conversation, and a service that will remain relevant to people if people don't feel safe to speak up in the first place. So for all those who believe in free expression and all those who believe in free speech, it's critical that we're not utilizing technologies like Twitter to shut down voices.
Liberal media's tough stance on the Capitol siege Trumpists also has long-term ramifications that will widen the gap in America. It also unashamedly panders to the Democrats. That is how the media is playing its part in the American divide.
It's no surprise to see distrust in media, as well as rising partisanship, extremism, and even domestic terrorism. But how did we get here? Let's see what Kristen Harris thinks. Mr. Harris, your take.
I think that the major issue with disinformation is it pushes people to go look in different areas for their news. For example, you have a larger amount of people than ever that are getting their news from forums, like what we saw with the QAnon thing, where they no longer trust the mainstream media narrative due to all the disinformation that to them is easily debunked because they can go search on the internet for alternative facts or different informations or downloads that may support their point of view.
Take what the conservatives call cancel culture and how it's raging today on social media. Many right-wing figures are being canceled on social media, and the conservative voice is being silenced at a time when the election is being disputed and recognition of the new president is under question.
So what happened with your Twitter account and the company page?
Well, first, mine was taken down because we have all the election fraud with these Dominion machines. We have 100% proof. And then when they took it down about 3 weeks ago, and then when I put it back up, my personal, I put a It was a
Mike, thank you very much. You're talking about machines that we at Newsmax have not been able to verify any of those kinds of allegations. We just want to let people know that there's nothing substantive that we've seen. And let me read you something there. While there were some clear evidence of some cases of vote fraud and election irregularities, the election results in every state were certified.
As liberals retake power in the year 2021, the left-leaning media looks more aggressive than ever in the wake of the Trump era. The liberal agenda and how it is using mass media to promote it is a lengthy one. But forced equity, diversity, as well as political correctness are reshaping the American society in a fashion that could ultimately spin out of control. So what are the costs of a biased media today?
Adrenaline junkies and people of different right-wing groups were involved, and one of those was QAnon people. And the reason why people turn to things like QAnon, it's because the media has become so biased to one point of view, to the point where a whole half of the United States doesn't deem them credible. And even the people on the left question what the mainstream media narrative is. So what it does is it forces people to get their news from forums where strange people post bizarre beliefs, and when you ban all the independent media, essentially under the guise of Russian collusion, there's no gatekeeper there.
The pace of media takeovers by large national and multinational corporations has been increasing since mid-20th century. Currently, six giant conglomerates control 90% of what media consumers read, watch, and listen to. General Electric, Viacom, Time Warner, CBS, News Corp, and Disney control a majority of American-owned media.
Together, these six empires, federations, alliances own about 90% of all media in the United States. In 1983, or the old Republic era, there were 50 companies owning that same share of media. So why is this important? Should you be worried? Well, it's not exactly a black and white issue.
Enormous media conglomerates have expanded their influence, leading to a shortage of meaningful content and alternative viewpoints. Trust in the news media is being eroded, and some communities are growing in their own alternate reality, yielded by the one-sided media they consume. How do media treat those trying to disrupt its agenda?
I think the idea of this pro-Trump revolution was terrifying enough that they've now put the stakes down. Because even before this, they started to ban conservatives who are more, more eccentric conservatives, more vibrant conservatives, like Alex Jones and a few others. But now they've just blanket attack any conservative who is conservative or right-wing enough to not accept their agenda.
Trump's supporters' attack on the Capitol is one contemporary example of how media falsehood could create cults. The former president's fans refused to accept the reality that Trump's allegations of election fraud had been left out of court.
They then began fantasizing about how their leader had a hidden trick up his sleeve not to allow Biden to enter office as the president.
Hundreds of thousands of people here, and I just want them to be recognized by the fake news media. Turn your cameras, please, and show what's really happening out here, because these people are not going to take it any longer. They're not going to take it any longer. All of us here today do not want to see our election victory stolen by emboldened radical left Democrats, which is what they're doing, and stolen by the fake news media. That's what they've done and what they're doing. We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. You don't concede when there's theft involved.
So in reality, they rushed at the request of the president to supposedly save their democracy and their votes. The other side of the coin is the thirst for truth by the youth, women, people of color, and immigrants, which is yet to be quenched. But what role did U.S. media play in the deadly breach of the Capitol by Trump supporters, and what are the aftermath?
That's an important thing, because remember, the media always has the option to just ignore something. If it didn't happen on TV, it didn't happen, is the old expression. I would say that maybe now if it didn't happen on YouTube, it didn't happen. We could update that for the 21st century. But they did choose to show it. But they definitely made it clear that these people are bad. They are all Nazis, even the black people who were part of it, and so on. They put a very clear sort of framing on it, and that somehow it is definitely Trump being at fault.
The narrative is controlled by virtue of the ownership of giant media corporations. Many media property owners tend to follow the approach adopted by elected officials who know the truth, but instead choose to propagate lies. Controlled by one czar, the American public would have a good reason to fear for its democracy and remain skeptic about what they read on social media outlets.
Multiple, well-documented significant harms. And we actually have to confront these harms head-on when trying to make decisions about whether or not we embrace this technology and let it into our lives. So one of these harms that we know this technology brings has to do with your professional success. So I just argued before that the ability to focus intensely to produce things that are rare and valuable, to hone skills that the marketplace values, that this is what's going to matter in our economy. But right before that, I argued that social media tools are designed to be addictive.
Stereotype of an American surfing through TV channels somehow captures the struggle for finding out truth. But those high up want to stay in power, prepared to do whatever it takes to manipulate the discourse. How successful have czars controlling U.S. media been in manipulating the narrative?
Well, pretty effective. It's been effective enough to get the United States involved in a lot of wars. The United States has entered World War I, Vietnam, the Iraq and Afghanistan wars over very dubious claims. I mean, we never found those weapons of mass destruction, did we? So in a lot of ways, the narrative is created by the media. And in fact, there's really no other narrative outside of theirs. They control that, they create it, and for better or worse, we receive it. And unfortunately, it would look like as time goes on, it gets worse and worse.
There is no real access to truly diverse and competing sources of news, literature, entertainment, and popular culture. Concentrated power over public information has created a niche for the alternatives. Some are taking advantage of the gap in the market by promoting conspiracy theories. Trump was a master of employing conspiracy theories and using them to his advantage.
You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. The FBI conducted a year-long investigation into my emails. They concluded there was no case. He said the FBI was rigged. He lost the Iowa caucus. He lost the Wisconsin primary. He said the Republican primary was rigged against him. Then Trump University gets sued for fraud and racketeering. He claims the court system and the federal judge is rigged against him. There was even a time when he didn't get an Emmy for his TV program 3 years in a row, and he started tweeting that the Emmys were rigged.
What is the liberal agenda, and how is it using mass media to promote it? That's what Danny's going to talk about today. Hello, Danny. What do you have for us?
Thank you, Milad. This week, I am talking diversity and answering the questions, does diversity in the United States lead to justice? Does it lead to peace? And how does diversity maintain the status quo amid unprecedented crisis and societal decay? The answer is no. Diversity does not lead to justice, and it doesn't lead to peace. The corporate media has praised Joe Biden for his diverse cabinet, and the Los Angeles Times has given the front page to Kamala Harris, his vice president, who is a black woman, and has praised Joe Biden for nominating Lloyd Austin as the Secretary of Defense. Yet Lloyd Austin was a board member of Raytheon, one of the major weapons manufacturers in the world, which produces weapons of mass destruction deployed in black and brown nations around the world to destroy them. Kamala Harris is an agent of the police state, of the mass incarceration state, as a DA and as a prosecutor and as a senator. She has mocked activists for advocating for the defunding of prisons and the funding of public education. She has also been responsible for massive arrests of black Americans, mainly for minor drug possession. These are not the kind of leaders that diversity should be promoting. So why does the corporate media promote this kind of diversity? Because, in fact, a more diverse empire is a more effective empire. The United States is able to wage wars around the world institute devastating economic inequality, and maintain a racist power structure, all the while claiming that it in fact has gotten closer to being less racist because of diversity. This is what leads to developments like Donald Trump and the extreme right. And we need to understand how diversity does not mean justice and peace if we are going to have a more progressive and more peaceful future in the United States and abroad.
In the late Obama era, Trump took the chance to put his ideas into test. He told America's story in a rather novel way compared to the US media, and many gravitated to him. After 4 years in office, the president fabricated tens of thousands of lies and baseless allegations, but his supporters still considered him the only honest man in the room. So what were the dynamics of the communication between Trump and his supporters?
Media is the reason why Donald Trump used Twitter. He used it as a way to talk directly to the American people. Not that I agree with the things he said, but it was for the first time in history that we've seen a president be able to communicate directly with the people, and they did this through Twitter. Now, making threats on Twitter, do I think that's a presidential thing to do? Absolutely not. I think that maybe some of it was for show. Some of it was so that the message may not be perverted, but I think a phone call and a conversation would have been a much better option.
Media is at the center of the American power play. Having a real choice of politics and ideas has become a more scarce phenomenon, as many people repeat the talking points fed to them by media, and that is their political view. The media knows that and is somehow making a benefit by pumping that certain attitude towards life and politics.
It's important to believe in, you know, to have respect for everyone's religion.
Do you respect Christianity?
I do.
Judaism?
Yes.
Islam?
No.
Can a woman be president?
The presidency is a man's job.
I have women are qualified to be president.
No. A female has more hormones. She could start a war in 10 seconds.
The people tend to follow news outlets they agree with. The outlets are making money through their supporters, so they're more adamant in highlighting what their viewers want. They could help one another get increasingly ignorant.
The media has the ability to turn the light switch on and off using their data. And for some people, it works very well as far as controlling information and allowing people to download certain viewpoints and conditioning them that certain things are acceptable. There's a large and growing amount of cognitive dissonance amongst Americans due to them watching media.
In a society where inaccuracy and biases abound, seeking truth remains a serious challenge. Media property owners must be held accountable, along with elected officials, for lying to the nation and opting for power over truth. Yet in reality, both the media and officials mostly choose to propagate lies, serving their own interests.
You use words like garbage and lies and smear to describe the recent wave of stories about your past. Are you saying that organizations like Politico and CNN and the Wall Street Journal are deliberately trying to damage you?
Yes.
Why?
To put it simply, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Why?
Because, you know, when you deliberately lie and you put that out as a story, or you do shabby investigation and you say, we've investigated and we can't find anything. I mean, is that an acceptable standard? I mean, you're in the media. Is that acceptable?
Generally, journalists have to nail down a story before they publish it or broadcast it.
Right. So I don't have any problem with people looking at my past. I don't have any problem whatsoever with being vetted. But when people are outright dishonest, that's worrisome to me.
Our guest tonight is Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist
and author of the new book, Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Ted, thank you for joining us. Let's get to it. We want to know basically to what extent the American public has lost faith in what is sometimes referred to as the mainstream media.
There's a allegory relating to people's congressmen. Congress for a long time in the United States has had an approval rating hovering around 10, 11, 12%. And yet incumbent congressmen keep getting reelected. So why? It's because people don't like Congress in general, but they like their own congressmen, or at least they're willing to tolerate them. Same thing I think is true about distrust of corporate media. In general, people have an understanding that systemically they don't trust what comes out of corporate media, that it's a lot of it's propaganda, that the corporate ownership has a huge influence. But in terms of the outlets that they like or that they tolerate, or perhaps more accurately, that they dislike the least, for example, if you're a conservative, that might be Fox. If you're a liberal, that might be MSNBC. They have more of a love-hate relationship with those outlets. And even though they might say that they don't trust the whole system, the fact is they do listen to and watch to these and read these outlets, and it ends up being the source of much of what they believe. So it's, if there was really widespread distrust of all corporate media outlets in the U.S., they wouldn't really have substantial influence, but they clearly do. They shape the narrative in a very real way, so that things that are not true become true and they become widely accepted. So, for example, Russiagate scandal, or that are, you know, didn't happen, but, you know, most Americans think it did, especially depending on which outlet you watch. So it's kind of like the Congress thing. People don't trust the whole thing overall, but whether they admit it to themselves, much less to pollsters, or not, there are outlets that they are listening to, watching, and reading, and they are trusting them, even though maybe they shouldn't.
Interesting stuff, as always. We want to thank you so much, Ted, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for tuning in. For We the People, I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Whether it's about the election, public health, or climate change, divide rages on in U.S. media today. This is while the elite in control of news and entertainment keep targeting the average person consuming immense amounts of information, news, and entertainment every day, a phenomenon that has made a large number of Americans addicted to the media. Thank you. Please join us again next week when we'll come back with another episode of We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Jury selection began on Monday, 8th of March, in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in connection with George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Tim Arango and Sheila Dewan. The piece is titled, First Challenge in George Floyd Murder Trial, Finding an Impartial Jury. Stay with us for more of Tim Arango and Sheila Dewan's article. Jury selection began on Monday, 8th of March, in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer charged in connection with George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Late last year, a 14-page questionnaire began arriving in mailboxes across Minneapolis and its suburbs. It asked if the recipient had watched a video of George Floyd dying under a police officer's knee. What about the protests against police brutality, it wanted to know. Did you go? How do you feel about Black Lives Matter? It asked respondents to list their education level, any martial arts training, even their favorite podcasts. And then there was the essay prompt, followed by a daunting expanse of blank paper. Tell us everything you have heard about the death of George Floyd. The questionnaire went out to potential jurors for the trial of Derek Chauvin, the white police officer accused of murdering George Floyd, who was black. The case has touched the lives of millions and sparked the largest movement for racial justice in America since the 1960s. But the trial will ultimately decide the guilt or innocence of one man. Jury selection began on Monday, 8th of March, in a courtroom built to comply with pandemic protocols and outfitted with television cameras. Mr. Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Before his trial begins, he could face an additional charge of third-degree murder, the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled on Friday, in a decision that could delay the start of jury selection because Derek Chauvin has the option to appeal. Trials in police killings are rare. This one comes during a seismic shift in attitudes about race, racism, and policing, sparked in large part by the videos showing George Floyd pinned underneath police officers for more than 9 minutes. The videos show him crying for his mother as onlookers pleaded with the police officers to let him breathe. The trial follows months of protests by those who want the criminal justice system to hold the police accountable for violence, punctuated by sharp disappointments like a lack of indictments for police officers in the deaths of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, and Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York. Prosecutors will probably show the video in court as much as the judge will allow to argue that Derek Chauvin's use of force violated police department policy and that he committed murder by keeping his knee on George Floyd's neck even after George Floyd went silent. The defense will attempt to portray what many view as a simple set of facts captured on video as something more complicated, probably by arguing that Mr. Floyd's drug use and underlying health conditions were the real cause of his death. Minneapolis, where neighborhoods and storefronts still bear the scars of last summer's looting and arson, is already bracing for unrest if Derek Chauvin is acquitted. Concrete barriers around government buildings and high fencing topped with razor wire have transformed downtown into a fortress and blocked off one of the most popular sites for large demonstrations. National Guard soldiers will stand watch. George Floyd's family will gather along with social justice activists and civil rights leaders like the Reverend Al Sharpton, who recently told reporters that Derek Chauvin lynched George Floyd with his knee. And there are fears that members of the same white supremacist groups that ransacked the Capitol building in Washington on 6th of January might descend on the Twin Cities. Inside the courtroom, though, a slow and deliberate process will play out as questioners probe prospective jurors for signs that they have already made up their minds. "I think it's going to be extremely difficult to pick a jury," said Susan Gartner, the former top prosecutor in nearby St. Paul, who is now in private practice. Susan Gartner added, "There have been few incidents in our state that have had as much impact on the community. It's hard to imagine finding a juror who is enough of a blank slate to really give both sides a fair hearing." It is expected to take 3 weeks just to seat a jury of 12 members and up to 4 alternates. Lawyers for both sides may have already begun vetting jury pool members, checking their social media posts. They would have read the returned questionnaires, which are not publicly available, and will use them as a starting point for questions intended to ferret out anything that is proxy for political bias. "Down to their bumper stickers," said Ted Sumsel Jones, a professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. The questions will help the lawyers pinpoint ideological leanings and flesh out fuller portraits of each prospective juror. The defense will be looking for candidates who are politically conservative and favorably disposed towards law enforcement, while the prosecution may prefer young, highly educated people with liberal leanings. The judge is supposed to strike any potential juror who shows an inability to set aside his or her preconceptions. In addition, the prosecution may strike 9 potential jurors of its choice, and the defense may strike 15. Judge Peter A. Cahill has taken special steps to protect the jury from interference and security threats. Jurors will not be publicly identified during the trial. They will be sequestered during deliberations and possibly during the trial itself. Inside the courtroom, pandemic-related precautions will allow for only 2 spectators, one from George Floyd's family and the other from Derek Chauvin's family. Three other police officers involved in George Floyd's death, J. Alexander Kwang, Thomas Lane, and Tu Thao, will be tried separately. Judge Peter Cahill has denied a motion by Derek Chauvin's lawyer, Eric Nelson, to move the trial because of the enormous amount of publicity it has already generated, but the judge said he might reconsider. Dan Herbert, a criminal defense lawyer who has represented numerous police officers, including Jason Van Dyke, who was convicted in 2019 of murdering Laquan McDonald in Chicago, said the problem with holding the trial in Minneapolis was not so much that residents could not be impartial, but that they might be swayed by intense community pressure. "It will be much easier for them to come back with a verdict of guilty than a verdict of not guilty," he said. The defense should be looking for 1 or 2 holdouts who would not cave to public opinion, he said. "You're just looking for somebody that is a leader," he said, "and somebody who's maybe even going to stay aloof from the other jurors." Moving the trial would inevitably mean moving it to a whiter area of Minnesota, in a case where racial makeup of the jury will be a primary concern. In the Rodney King case in Los Angeles, California, in the early 1990s, the 4 police officers caught on video beating Mr. King were acquitted after their trial was moved to the predominantly white neighborhood of Simi Valley, touching off violent riots. At around the same time in Minneapolis, protests rocked the city following an all-white grand jury's decision not to indict a white police officer, Dan May, who fatally shot a black teenager in the back. Minneapolis is about 64% white and 20% black, whilst the jury pool in its county, Hennepin, was 80% white and just 8% black in the 2020 fiscal year, according to figures from the State Court Administrator's office. The difference reflects the fact that the county is whiter than the city, and black potential jurors tend to be slightly underrepresented in the jury pool. Jury diversity is important for two reasons, experts have said. Research shows that just as diverse corporations and institutions perform better, so do juries, benefiting from multiple perspectives. And if the jury lacks racial diversity, its verdict would likely not be viewed as legitimate. Paul Butler, a former prosecutor and professor at Georgetown University Law School, expressed concern that some questions, asking whether prospective jurors agreed with a series of statements about race and policing, might be used to disqualify people of color, even when the statement is objectively true. For example, the statement Minneapolis police officers are more likely to respond with force when confronting black suspects than when dealing with white suspects. But, Mr. Herbert, the defense lawyer, said, private polling conducted before the Van Dyke trial showed that the vast majority of black residents were predisposed to convict. In these police cases where it's a white police officer and a black victim, it is virtually impossible to find a significant number of blacks that have not prejudged the case, for many reasons, not the least of which is what they have gone through likely in the past. On the other hand, legal experts say having too many white jurors would probably stack the deck in favor of the defense, because people tend to have less natural empathy for someone of a different race, in this case, George Floyd, and white people are more likely to favor law enforcement.
Ministry.
We are facing a new page from the pages of the resistance, in which the weapons of the resistance will reach all of the occupation forces and its bases in any part of the homeland. This is what the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units announced last week as a new phase of resistance against U.S. forces in the country, vowing confrontation with the occupiers until the full liberation of Iraq. Why this announcement now? Well, it was inevitable after the U.S. military attacked Popular Mobilization Units, PMU, troops patrolling the Iraqi-Syrian border. See, when you bomb the only force on the ground capable of defeating Daesh, then by all means you are creating a safe corridor for Daesh terrorists to return to Iraq from the Syrian terrorist pockets, which, surprise, surprise, falls under your U.S. territorial control. By attacking Popular Mobilization Units on the Iraqi-Syrian border, U.S. President Joe Biden showed that his military decisions are not a far cry from those of his predecessor Donald Trump or his former boss Barack Obama. You see, we never forget and we never forgive. We never forgot when in 2016, Obama sent his warplanes to carry out the deadliest airstrike against the Syrian Arab Army that resulted in the death of 62 Syrian troops, wounded 100 more, and opened the way for a Daesh offensive on Deir ez-Zor. His lame excuse was he thought they were Daesh. Yep, the most advanced military on the planet got their intel wrong because they really wanted to help out the Syrian Arab Army in taking down these Daesh terrorists, but oops, they wiped the Syrian Arab Army out by mistake. It is only normal then for the Iraqi resistance to see confrontation as the only option that guarantees their freedom and their dignity of their own homeland after exhausting all the means that others have bet on with the U.S. occupation. Biden needs to understand this fast enough before his troops start paying the price of his risky business. The Iraqi resistance is an Iraqi decision, and its choice is the choice of the Iraqi people, and it will continue to sacrifice until Iraq is liberated from the filth of the occupation. That is the Iraqi decision, and the U.S. will find itself compelled to act accordingly. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, Amar Osman. Recent attacks against the U.S. occupation forces, a statement by Iraq's resistance factions declared last week that the resistance has the legal and national right and popular support to confront the occupiers until the liberation of Iraq, but will not target diplomatic missions. The statement came a day after 10 Grad rocket attacks against the Ain al-Assad airbase took place hosting the American forces in the western Iraqi province of Anbar. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the Iraqi resistance has declared that it sees confrontation as the only option against the U.S. occupation forces, which guarantees the dignity and the sovereignty and the freedom of their nation, Iraq. After exhausting, this is what they said, after exhausting all means of diplomacy with the occupation. That was declared just 1 week after Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi reaffirmed his government's maybe commitment, alliance, whatever he wants to call it, with the United States of America. Should the Iraqi resistance, mainly all the PMU units, be concerned that their country's cabinet might actually turn on them?
Yes, hi, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
I guess the Iraqis fed up with the American occupation, and for a long time, Iraq is not a free land or a free land, no man's land. It has owners, nationality, and culture, and sovereignty, independence. And I guess the PMU are responsible for the Iraqis to tell them what's going to happen with their country, especially after they kicked out the Daesh. And we know that Daesh is a child born of America. And I guess also the Americans, they have no pretext to stay in the Iraqi territories, especially that they look at the PMU as an enemy, and these are Iraqis. So since then, we have to expect from the PMU to declare a war against the American troops, especially the occupiers in some bases like Ain al-Assad or other places. Of course, they won't attack the diplomatic team because there is a kind of political relationship and diplomatic relationship between the Iraqi government and the Americans. Now, the question is for the government, whether they have to implement the parliament's decision to make agreement, let the Americans go from or withdraw completely, totally, without conditions from Iraqi territories. That has to be decided in the government. And there should be a kind of pressure from all the community, whether in the middle or in the south and in the north, pressure on the government in order to take this decision as fast as possible. because the Iraqis won't be able to be patient more with the Americans, especially after they attack some of the places, some of the posts of the PMU.
Well, that's interesting because we all know that the northern part of Iraq is a bit under, not a bit, it's actually fully under the control of the United States of America, especially the Kurdistan region. But the Iraqi resistance statement, it was obvious, and it said, we are facing a new page from the pages of the resistance in which the weapons of the resistance will reach the occupation in any part of the homeland. This just opens up a lot of debates in Iraq, especially about the autonomous region, the self-proclaimed autonomous region of Kurdistan, but how do you think that might affect the internal, maybe Iraqi political scene because the U.S. has played a vital role in brainwashing the youth of Iraq?
Well, first and foremost, the northern part of Iraq under the sovereignty of some of the Kurds parties, they have to remember and they have to make sure that this PMU, this army, this resistance did not leave the Daesh to take over the northern part under the leadership of the two martyrs, the great martyrs, Al-Hajj Qasim Soleimani and Hajj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and their companions. These martyrs and their blood should really purify the Iraqi territories from the occupiers, whether these occupiers were the Americans or the Daesh or whatever you can name and you can call. Unless the Kurds and in the central part in Iraq and the south, they understand that Iraqis should unite in order to confront the American occupation. Otherwise, they become parts, and then they give a lawful kind of occupation for the Americans. And this is a precedent. This is has no way in order to reunite the Iraqi people and the Iraqi territories. There is one government, and all they participate in this government, and they have one parliament, and all in this parliament. Otherwise, I guess we'll see, as the Americans want, as Biden's government want, and
divided Iraq
want, the Iraqi territories will be divided into three parts. Which
well,
one?
The statement, Dr. Saleh, the statement issued by the Iraqi resistance came just one day after 10 Grad rockets struck the Ain al-Assad airbase, which is an American-occupied airbase in the western Iraqi province of Al-Anbar. The incident led to the death of two American personnel. They keep saying that they are contractors. I don't know what their business is there. They're American soldiers who died in inside of Iraq, being occupation soldiers, and it injured a lot of others as well. Hurting the U.S. occupation this way most definitely will prompt Biden to maybe up the ante and show some force against the Iraqis in general, the Iraqi resistance, before going to any part of negotiations with them. How risky will Biden's game be if he actually goes down the road of further escalation and further targeting bases of the Iraqi resistance?
Well, I guess the Iraqis at the PMU, they have the pretext and they have all the causes in order to let the Americans go out and tell them that the Americans are planning to go out from Afghanistan, and they made a kind of treaty with the Taliban. And now in Iraq, I guess the government now is responsible for asking the Americans to withdraw from Iraq, and the Iraqis will be satisfied. Otherwise, the Americans implant corruption, division, all kinds of bad things in Iraq. And guess if they wanna lean to the Americans, the Iraqis won't be satisfied and won't find peace in their country. They have to choose, I guess, especially the government, and in the northern part, and in the other places. They have to choose either Iraq or America. They have to choose either one person or one community and one part of Iraq or the Iraqi community. They have no other choice. They have no option. This PMU of people who are sacrificing themselves, their blood, in order to unite Iraq. Not for only one group or one ethnic group or one place. No, I guess the Iraqis are really aware, I guess, are really aware of the American plans for Iraq. They have to confront these plans.
Thank you, Dr. Saleh, for being with us. That's unfortunately the time that we have for this segment. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, academic and political commentator, for joining us over Skype from Beirut. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we're going to talk about the papal visit to Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In his very first papal visit to Iraq, Pope Francis spent 4 days in the crisis-stricken nation, during which he traveled both north and south, calling for arms to be silenced and an end to acts of violence and extremism. A landmark visit that saw the first closed-door meeting between the Pope and the Iraqi Shia Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani, whose fatwa against Daesh changed the face of Iraq within 3 years, leading to the defeat of the terrorist group and making way for Iraq's Christians to safely return to their homeland. Pope Francis visits Iraq in this following report.
Pope Francis arrived in Baghdad last week, kicking off his 33rd apostolic journey abroad and the very first papal visit to Iraq. Pope Francis spent 4 days in Iraq, during which he traveled north and south as a pilgrim seeking peace, fraternity, and reconciliation, as he himself has said. His intense schedule foresaw moments of prayer and encounter with Christian communities and representatives of the Catholic Church in Iraq, as well as meetings to foster interreligious dialogue, the highlight of which was a landmark meeting with Iraq's top Shia cleric Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani. The two religious leaders met at Sistani's humble home in the holy city of Najaf. The visit is one of the highlights of the pontiff's trip to Iraq, where the cleric has played a key role in tamping down tensions. Sistani, 90 years old, is one of the most senior clerics in Shia Islam, and his rare but powerful political interventions have helped shape present-day Iraq. He is a deeply revered figure in Shia-majority Iraq, and his opinions on religious and other matters are sought by Shias worldwide. Pope Francis then visited parts of northern Iraq that were once held by Daesh terrorists on the third day of his historic trip to the country. In those same areas, Daesh terrorists overran the region in 2014, destroying historic churches and looting. Christians have been returning there since Daesh was defeated in 2017 at the hands of none other than the Iraqi Popul Mobilization Units led by Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who were both assassinated in Baghdad last year at the hands of the U.S. occupation forces. Later on Sunday, the Pope celebrated Mass at a football stadium in Erbil with up to 10,000 attendees. This is also the same city that came under direct threat from Daesh but was saved by Commander Soleimani's intervention at the last minute. Many people find this apostolic trip a historic one, especially that the Pope's safe visit to Baghdad would have never happened had it not been for the significant sacrifices of Iraq's heroes from the Popular Mobilization Units and their commanders.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mataz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mataz. Now, let me set things a bit straight here about the Pope's visit to Baghdad. It would have never been able to take place
It would have never happened had it not been for the significant sacrifices of Iraq's resistance and the commanders, the direct commanders of the resistance, namely the deputy director of the PMU, Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and Lieutenant General Qasim Soleimani, who were...